Heyo, and here we go. Welcome to another episode of We Talk Music. I am your host, Mr. Brett Podcast. I am the chief defender of the faith and one half of your metal nerds. But you're not here to listen to me. No, no, no. You are here to listen to our extra special guest. This man is a favorite of We Talk Music. He is the drummer for Quiet Riot, Mr. Frankie Benali. Frankie, how are you doing?
We're getting ready to start another touring year. This Saturday, we're playing our first show of 2019 in Scottsdale, Arizona, to be live.
That's amazing. And yeah, I mean, we're here to talk about primarily about the new album, Live in Milan. I had a listen to it. It sounds really good. I mean, you know, it's so different with James at the lead singing position for sure.
Yeah, it's a different Quiet Riot. I never expected it to be the same as it was with Kevin, because Kevin was a very unique singer with a crazy range and amazing stage persona. But having said that, James has done an amazing job at the same time, because vocally he has the range to be able to cover that material that is so iconic. But he's also a great performer on stage, and he's a really, really nice guy. So I'm really happy with the way this record has turned out.
Yeah, that was one of the things, because I watched a couple of the videos as well that go along with it, and I think that did strike me about him was the fact that his presence on stage really, really stood out. Is that something that you were kind of really looking for when you were searching for that new lead singer?
Well, it's something that I hope to find, but also understanding that Kevin was such a unique performer and so energetic. And you know, by and large, those are very few to find around. I mean, if you look at the genre, there weren't that many to start out with. And as time has gone on with replacement members and other bands as well, you know, that was always something that was difficult to find. And we were very fortunate to not only have somebody that has the range to sing the songs, but has his own vocal personality at the same time that he brings to the table, which I welcome, and is also a great performer and a really nice guy. So, you know, it was a very fortunate trifecta for us.
Yeah, because I guess at this point you really have to find somebody that fits within the, you know, because I mean, you guys as a whole have been together for quite a few years in this version, and so you would really have to find somebody who fit and worked well with you.
Yeah, well, you know, when you take into consideration our bassist Chuck Wright has been part of Quiet Riot on and off since 1982. But both he and Alex have been a part of this lineup since 2004, when Kevin was still alive, and all the way through Kevin's untimely. All of us are friends, and we know each other, and we spend enough time around each other. We know each other's personality. There's no surprises in that regard. And we went through a number of singers, and it's like anything else. You don't know what you're getting until you spend time with a person, because initially everybody puts on their, you know, their best face for you, and it only time reveals the actual individual and who they are and what they are. And we were lucky to be able to have James cover the band. So he's now starting our second year with this touring cycle.
Yeah, that's What does a tour for Quiet Riot look like now, then?
Well, it's different than it was in the past. I mean, in the glory days, you know, you make a record and then you go out and spend, you know, most of the year in a bus touring. And now, unless you're, you know, Kiss, Aerosmith, Motley Crue, when they get back together again, yes. Unless you're one of those bands that can do, you know, those long tours, by and large, most of the bands, if not all the bands in our genre, from the 80s, are mostly doing weekend things where you play anywhere from 2 to 4 shows a week, and then you come home for a few days and you go back out again. And that's fine too, because it gives me the opportunity, which is Quiet Riot, but it also gives
Yeah, because I mean, you handle all the business for Quiet Riot, so I mean, and I think that's kind of what you've taken it. You've taken it towards being a business in that regard.
You really, I've always looked at music business like the weather. You expect it to be sunny, but you better have an umbrella for those stormy days. And I'm, I've been here weathering out the storm for over 3.5 decades.
Yeah, that's that deserves some applause for sure for being able to do that.
Well, thank you very much. I'm still, I always tell people I'd rather be 5 feet 11 inches above the ground than 6 feet under it.
Yeah. Very good. So I want to talk a little bit about Thunderbird because I mean it's such an amazing song. Now, is there like kind of do you feel ex a certain expectation that you want to live up to with it? I mean, the fact that you had Alessandro Del Vecchio on it, I mean, he is amazing. So like that automatically just gives you such a boost, I would think.
Well, the thing about that song is that it's a very personal song, excuse me, for Quiet Riot, and it's a song that when Kevin was still with us, every time we performed it, he always dedicated it to the memory of Randy Rhoads. And after Kevin passed, and I decided to continue the band 3 years after that, I made a conscious decision that. It was an important song for Quiet Riot. Randy was an important part of the first version of Quiet Riot, and Kevin was an important and integral part of the band. And it deserved to continue to be played, and it deserved to have now Kevin honored the same as Randy was honored by Kevin and the band. The what made it special for the One Night Live in Milan is that the original studio version of the song was recorded with a piano intro and piano throughout the song, but we had never performed it live that way. And I already knew Alessandro Del Vecchio, and I knew that he was not only a great musician and a great pianist, but also a really, really nice guy. And I knew that he was going to produce the live record, so it made sense for me to ask him if he would like to participate, and he was humbled and thrilled, and he did a beautiful job on it. So it brought the song for me full circle from being recorded in 1982 with piano to actually being performed live, 3.5 decades later, as it was intended.
I mean it's such a beautiful song and it's so great that that you're able to perform it live. With this new lineup, like do you feel like there's a sense of stability here? You've released Road Rash, Road Rage, sorry.
Road rage,
Yes, I had somebody mentioned Road Rash to me earlier, so it got stuck in my head.
That's funny.
But you've released Road Rage, so then do you think that you'll release more albums on a more consistent basis with this lineup?
Well, I think that there's the likelihood that if we have the opportunity to go into the studio and record another record and release it, it really depends on whether there's a deal on the table from Frontiers or not to do so beyond the scope of the live record. I've already written a number of songs with my writing partner, Neil Citron, because I have to stay current. I mean, I love playing the Quiet Riot songs and the Quiet Riot catalog, and they never get old to me. But the other side of the coin is I constantly have to keep moving forward musically because that's what a musician should do. So it's entirely possible that there'll be another studio record in the future. And this lineup is very solid and everybody's very happy. And as long as everyone continues to enjoy it, then that's up to the individuals to continue doing Quiet Riot.
Right, yeah. So now, one of the other questions that I wanted to ask was about the documentary. Do you think that it got the recognition and I think the longevity that you expected when you released it?
Well, documentaries traditionally have a very narrow market, and I'm not just talking about music documentaries. Documentaries in general aren't perceived to be as important as a scripted film. So you already have that to work with. And then music documentaries, for the most part, are you know, in a space on a shelf all their own. I'm really thrilled with the success of the documentary because it gave the fans and also people that you know, maybe were not particularly interested in Quiet Riot but were interested in music from that period of time. It gave them a really honest, real-time look at what it's like to be in a band from the glory days all the way until real time. So I have no regrets about it whatsoever. I think Regina Russell did an amazing job putting together not only all the filming that she had to do in real time, but, you know, going through the archives and picking and choosing what could be included given the time restraints of a film.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, documentaries are very interesting. I mean, I'm a huge fan of music documentaries, so it's great. And I wish everybody could just get Regina to work on a whole bunch more.
You know, it's a lot of, you know, it's a lot of hard work. She put a lot of time in it, a lot of hard work. And, you know, everybody thinks that everything, you know, when they get the quote unquote product in their hands, whether it's the Quiet Riot documentary or a record, that it created itself, and it really doesn't create itself. It's a lot of time and work and blood and sweat that goes into it. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I appreciate the fact that you're still willing to give the blood and sweat for the fans because I know I myself do appreciate the fact that you're still out here playing.
Yeah, but the only reason I'm still out here playing is because of the fans. If the fans were not supportive, if the fans were not interested, if the fans were not willing to invest, you know, time and money by going to the shows or buying, you know, buying the CDs or the DVDs, then none of it would be possible. So, as much of the success that Quiet Riot has had has been because we put in the time and we put in the hard work and the effort and a lot of luck. Ultimately, if it wasn't for the fans, we still wouldn't be here and you and I would not be having this conversation. So, you know, my gratitude really goes to the fans. They've given me the life that I've had.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. So I want to go back a little bit because one of the questions that I have been itching to ask you for, oh my God, decades. When you were in Wasp, one of the things that I noticed about your time in Wasp was that's where I noticed you and said, holy crap, this guy is amazing, because your work on those, your work on those Wasp albums blew me away, because to me, you brought the drums out to become like a lead instrument with, you know, even though there's like a lead guitar, you know, you got Blackie Lawless, but there's suddenly the drums are a lead instrument. So I want to know, was that like you? Or was that partially you and Blackie?
No, that's completely. I mean, obviously, I had to work with the songs that Blackie had written, but he left everything to me to come up with the drum parts, and then there were certain things that he wanted me to do that were in sync with certain guitar parts that, you know, we had to sit down and work out. So he was constantly challenging me to really go as far as I could with the drumming, but the technical skill was already there, and I really love all that material. See, the problem is that, you know, because people are used to hearing me play fairly straight and fairly simple in the Quiet Riot songs, is I learned a long time ago that what's important to me is not playing drums. What's important to me is playing songs on the drums. And that's what makes the difference between, like you said, you know, it's almost a lead instrument on its own. It's because I was playing drums to the songs. I was playing the parts that I felt the song required in order to give them the momentum that they needed.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it because I mean, there's no question in my mind, like I will never forget, you know, the Crimson Idol and stuff and just hearing the fills and all that stuff in there. And the, you know, I mean, for me, it was awe inspiring.
Well, credit where credit is due. It's like I always say, it wasn't just me. It was myself, it was Blackie as a producer, and it was Blackie as a songwriter. Excuse me. Much like I say, you know, I love Led Zeppelin and I love John Bonham, and the John Bonham playing and the John Bonham drum sound is a product, obviously, of John Bonham, but also a product of the songs that, that Jimmy Page wrote and also the production that Jimmy did.
Yeah. So you've worked with so many different lead singers. What does it take to really, I guess massage egos? Because I mean, we know that like Blackie has a distinct personality. Kevin had a distinct personality. Like, what does it take, you know, to kind of work with these guys?
I've always been really honest with everybody I work with. And that's one of the reasons that Kevin and I got along so well, although we had our issues at some, you know, points of our lives. But, you know, I was always honest with him and he was honest with me where most things were concerned from his end. And the same thing with Blackie. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, I think I'm on 6, 7, 8 Wasp records over time. That doesn't happen because you're not getting along with somebody, or that doesn't happen because it's not working. It happens because you're getting along, and it happens because it's working. And that was the same situation with Kevin. When you get into some of the singers after Kevin and preceding James that didn't work out, is because I was brutally honest, and you know, in many respects, they weren't. You know, when you bring somebody new into the equation, they usually put their best foot forward and you know, try to be what they think you want them to be. But in, you know, in a short period of time, you really find out what people are really like. And that's one of the reasons those things didn't work. So honesty is key.
Yeah, for sure. I can well imagine, because there's just so many bands that implode, and I can only imagine that with a little bit more honesty, maybe they'd be able to work through it. But
I've never backed away from a fight. And sometimes when you're honest, you have to be prepared to get involved with a fight. And I don't mean a physical fight, but I mean, you know, the power struggle that always seems to be a part of bands and a part of the music industry.
So, going back to the Sunset Strip era and stuff like that, what are some of your favorite recollections of that time period?
That it was a party that really never ended. I people ask me, you know, were the 80s and was the Sunset Strip, you know, what it's been made out to be? It was a lot bigger, a lot more fun, and a lot more dangerous than what everybody has heard. And the great thing about it is that there were so many places to play, and there were so many bands that you could go out and hear two or three different bands at two or three different venues every single night of the week, 7 days a week. So our lives back then, and especially before the success of Quiet Riot, for us, our lives were centered around, you know, getting up late, rehearsing if we had rehearsal, getting ready and going out and having a great time going. Either you were playing someplace or you were going to see some friends play, and it was like that 7 days a week. It was really, really a wonderful time to be in LA. I mean, we were all broke, you know. It wasn't all like it wasn't like we were rolling in money. We weren't, and it wasn't like we had any luxuries. We didn't. Most of us didn't even have a car. But it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. What was the rehearsal space like that you worked in? Were you able to like rent a space, or was it kind of an apartment almost?
No, I mean, because Quiet Riot was always a loud band, we were always going to local rehearsal studios, and there were a lot of them in the San Fernando Valley. Excuse me. You know, we rehearsed at this little place called Uncle's, and then there was a friend of ours that owned a lighting company, and he let us rehearse there after the workday was done. So, you know, we always managed to come up with enough money for rehearsal money.
Do you think the Sunset Strip could ever happen again?
No, I don't think it could, because in the what made the Sunset Strip work was the fact that there was a music industry. The record labels were either in New York and or L.A. So, you know, that's the place to be. And record companies, for the most part, don't exist anymore. So there's not that thing of going to a club to play. And you know, on any given night, there could be two or three A&R people from a label looking to sign a band. And that doesn't happen anymore. There's less and less places to play. A lot of places now where before you played for a small guarantee or you might have played for the door, now a lot of places you have to pay them in order to play. So it's not fertile ground for that to happen again. And it's been a long decline. This didn't just happen in the 90s where the decline sort of started. The decline started a long time ago, because in the 60s it was even a much greater atmosphere to be in Hollywood and to play, and the same thing with the 70s. And then in the 80s, I think it was the last big boom for that to happen. There's radio, for the most part, doesn't play much new music, especially rock music. MTV really doesn't exist as a music TV channel anymore. So it's changed on so many levels that the Sunset Strip ever being what it was, I don't see it ever happening again. Sadly, but I don't see it ever happening again.
Yeah, I find it very interesting to kind of think about it, because when you look at the Sunset Strip, it has, I think, a similar, albeit much like shorter lifespan than, say, a Beale Street. And Beale Street has changed enormously over the decades, but you can still go out to Beale, and if you mention Beale, it's still a music walk in that regard. So.
Yeah, And what's great about it is the musicians are still out there, and they're putting bands together, and they're writing songs, and they have venues to play. But it's the end result that's much different now. The idea is the same. Musicians have always gotten together and put together bands because of their love of music and wanting to play music. The difference was that in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, there were record labels that were signing bands, and you had budgets and all of that, and that has disappeared. So what has stayed is the purest form of it, which is musicians wanting to practice their craft. And I think that's incredibly wonderful and admirable, but you know, unfortunately, the end of the rainbow is pretty empty now.
Yeah. This is, I guess, it's that period where the business really, really becomes such an issue now. Before, I mean, yes, at a certain point, you probably owed the record company, the record label, like millions of dollars, but at least there was a chance that you could recoup some of that money and get paid. Now it's like they don't even sign you, so you're forced to kind of go it on your own.
Yeah, somebody had just told me earlier today in another interview that there was a band that got a platinum record because they had sold 831 units but had 15,000 streams. You know, we were fortunate that at one point in time, the mental health record was selling between 35 and 50,000 copies a week.
Yeah.
So the gold and platinum records that, you know, all the members of Quiet Riot have on our walls, those were gold and platinums that we earned. You know, I have to discount a gold and platinum record. No disrespect to any artist, because I don't even know who the artist that this person cited is. He didn't tell me. But, you know, selling 831 copies is, it's, you know, it's not stellar, but that's the industry now. It's all about these streams that nobody is buying. So if you're in a band and you can, and you've got a huge fan base and you can get them to constantly stream your record, you're going to have something to hang up on your wall. Whether there's longevity in that, that's a question that we'll be able to answer maybe a decade from now.
Yeah, and then I guess we'll see if making albums still makes sense, you know, versus just recording singles as well.
Well, I'm a big believer. For me, and proof of that is that last year, August of last year, we released Road Rage, and that was all new music. For me, two things are important. For me, it's important to go out live and play the iconic music of Quiet Riot. But equally as important for me is to continue to make new Quiet Riot records and record new music. Whether anybody buys it or not, that's not the point. The point is to be creative and to continue to move forward, because that's what musicians are supposed to do. I mean, most jazz artists never made much money because most of the records didn't sell like a rock or a pop record would sell, and most of them were playing very small places. Yet they continued to record, create new music, and play these small places. Why? Because they're musicians, and that is very important to me. It always has been, and it always will be.
Yeah, no, that's great. Well, unfortunately, I am totally running out of time here, as I knew we could talk for a long time. This is the point in the interview where I give you the chance to plug your stuff, tell everybody where they can find the new album, because the Live in Milan album comes out on the 25th of January, so you can tell people where to find it and where to find you.
Yeah, One Night in Milan is available on CD, DVD, and Blu-ray, either directly from music, so just go on the internet, or you can go on Amazon and you can pick it up there. It comes out next Friday, the 25th of January. And one point that I want to make is that this record is a very true and honest live record, in that not a single note was overdubbed or re-recorded in the studio. It is what you hear. It's exactly as it was when we recorded it in Milan. There's no extra guitar tracks. There's no replaced guitar solos. There's no additional background vocals with a bunch of different singers. There's no lead vocal replacement. Not a single thing is replaced. It's exactly as it was One Night in Milan.
Wow, that's fantastic. Not enough bands do that, in my opinion. So it's, again, hats off to you for that.
Well, thank you very much. And like I said, the minute you go into the studio and replace anything on a live record, it ceases by definition being a live record. And I refuse to do so.
That's right. Well, Frankie Benelli, thank you so much for coming on the show. I truly appreciate it. And I hope that One Night Live in Milan sells so well for you, and that the future of Quiet Riot is extremely bright.
I appreciate it, Brett. You have a wonderful weekend. And again, my sincere gratitude for taking the time to chit-chat Quiet Riot.
Oh, yeah. Well, always happy to. Thank you.
All right, my friend. We'll be right back.
All right. We having a good time tonight or what? That's what I like to hear. We didn't come all this way to sleep, brothers and sisters. We came all this way to party. We came all this way to rock and roll.